It is Monday, December the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Italians vote no on reforms. What does that mean for the Eurozone?
I think there are certain reasons that the Italian politics will keep muddling through much in the same way as it's done. You know, we're not suggesting that Italy is anyway going to leave the European Union or even the Eurozone.
Trump team downplaying a Taiwan telephone call. Castro's remains buried where the Cuban Revolution began. Plus, we go to the scene of a deadly fire in California. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The populist five-star movement says it is ready to govern Italy now that Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is resigning. The movement spearheaded the winning of a no-vote campaign in a referendum on constitutional reforms on Sunday. Renzi had favored the reforms and told the nation, an hour after the polls closed, that he will resign later today. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty asked Monash University scholar Ben Wellings, an expert on politics of nationalism, Euroscepticism, and Brexit in the contemporary Europe, for his read on the Italy vote.
Coming so soon after Brexit and, of course, the similarities that there were with the election of Donald Trump, I think people are rightly concerned about it. It will add another element of instability into the Eurozone. This might expose some of the weakness of European banks. At the same time, I don't think it's quite as grave as much of a shock as Brexit. I think there are certain reasons that the Italian politics will keep muddling through much in the same way as it's done. You know, we're not suggesting that Italy is anyway going to leave the European Union or even the Eurozone. So it's an unwanted element of instability, but I think the European Union will see this one through.
Ben, some 70% of Italian voters went to the polls, and the margin of victory was nearly 60% for the no camp.
Yes, look, it's a very high turnout for Italian elections and also so-called second-order elections such as referendums. So, again, we seem to see that the device of a referendum has in some ways energized politics, or certainly energized certain sections of the electorate. And it's a clear rejection. So the question is, well, why did Renzi decide to take this path? Why did he stake his own political future on the outcome when, you know, David Cameron's example is so freshly in all our minds? And these will require some explaining by historians in years to come. But nevertheless, the No campaign was able to mobilize diverse parties and diverse interests against the idea of centralizing and streamlining power in Rome. So, but this is a clear rejection.
You mentioned banks. The biggest immediate loser could be Italy's third largest bank, which is bowed by bad loans, looking to raise some $5.3 billion this month to stave off collapse. How serious is the financial situation in Italy?
Well, it depends on what the markets decide to do. If they take fright and do not come to the aid of the banking sector in Italy, then yes, there could be problems. But I think this now depends on the political reaction that we see from President Mattarella in the coming hours as to how stability will be managed. And what I anticipate would be a so-called technocratic government drawing on the president will call on a cabinet minister, Padawan, probably, in order to bring about stability and hold this off as long as possible. You know, the next elections are scheduled for February 2018. Whether new elections will need to be called before that, but I think the idea would be to avoid elections in the short term.
In those elections, whenever they're held, what is the chance that an anti-Euro party like the Five Star Movement could make serious gains?
They could make serious gains. The Cinque Stelle, or Five Star Movement, had done very well at municipal elections earlier this year. They have a mayor of Rome and a mayor of Milan. We also need to consider the populist right Lega Nord, the Northern League, which is both anti-Euro and anti-Southern Italy as well. You know, so there's that political and economic divide in Italian politics coming through there. They could do very well. So we do need to bear in mind that they will probably make some gains here. Whether they'll be in a position to form government and whether they'll follow through, say, on five-star movements, plans to have a referendum on remaining a member of the euro, not the EU, but the euro, that, again, would remain to be seen, depending on how well they do in the elections and what kind of bargaining for positions of government might come thereby.
On the same day, Sunday, of course, big news in Austria, where the Freedom Party candidate Norbert Hofer was turned back. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's good news for anyone of who supports centrist politics. You know, we didn't need a far-right president of a European country. And I think that the Freedom Party of Austria represents a symbolic and actual threat to stability in Europe. In a way, you know, we can't characterize it as an insurgent party. It's been around since 1955. It was set up by a former Austrian SS general. It has strong links to anti-Semitic and far-right neo-Nazi parties in Austria. So it's a win for centrist democracy that Hofer has not been elected. So the picture is becoming a little bit mixed there. And you know, it may be that the kind of anti-populist forces are rallying, or it may simply be that the voters in Austria you know, felt that they'd done this once before. The election in November, which the Green candidate Van der Bellen also won very narrowly, was annulled and by an appeal by the Freedom Party of Austria, and they might be punishing Hofer for simply calling another election. So there are different ways of interpreting the result, but I think the outcome is a good one for Europe.
Ben Wellings is a professor at Monash University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Among the other stories we're following on VOA, monitors reporting dozens killed in Syrian airstrikes, U.S. announcing Guantanamo detainee release, and Afghan president says Taliban won't last without Pakistani support. We have expanded coverage of those stories a lot more at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's team is downplaying the significance of his telephone conversation with President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan, with which the United States has had no formal diplomatic ties since 1979. The call has stoked questions as to whether Trump intends to alter the long-standing U.S. acknowledgement of Beijing's one-China policy that precludes any official recognition of Taiwan. My colleague Jim Stevenson checked in with VOA correspondent Michael Bowman regarding Trump's tweets and any early international diplomacy.
Donald Trump's tweets continue to be a source of alternatingly consternation, humor, but this is something where there could actually be some real fallout on the world stage. Ever since the 1970s, the United States has accommodated the Chinese position on Taiwan, which is that Taiwan, for all intents and purposes, does not exist as a nation, that we adhere to the one China policy, which recognizes Beijing, which recognizes China. Nevertheless, the United States has had a military relationship with Taiwan for a very long time. Even though the United States does not officially recognize Taiwan, I mean, it would be silly to say that there are no relations between the two countries on military matters, on commercial matters. And so, apparently, President-elect Donald Trump got a phone call from Taiwanese leader Tsai. I suspect that if this had been done in secret and it had been kept under wraps, it would be no big deal. But Donald Trump, as he is prone to do, went on Twitter and announced it to the world.
I don't recall another president-elect from which we have heard so much information about phone calls and conversations with world leaders as they're coming into office as we've heard from Donald Trump. And I guess for those of us in the media who have a tough time covering him because access is difficult to Donald Trump, Twitter is a little bit of a treasure trove.
It almost calls into question whether he's going to need a communications secretary, a spokesperson of some sort, when he is, in essence, his own spokesperson. He takes to Twitter and says what's on his mind and announces things as they're happening. In all seriousness, obviously he's going to have a press secretary. But I suspect that that press secretary's job is going to be made interesting, shall we say, by the degree to which Donald Trump maintains his Twitter account.
We saw that on the campaign trail with his vice presidential candidate, Mike Pence, who often had to backtrack things that Trump was saying and kind of calm the waters a little bit, sometimes outright contradicting what Donald Trump said. And this was one of the points, too, that Hillary Clinton had made repeatedly in her campaign for the presidency, was that do you want somebody in office who's going to be just blurting out all this stuff on Twitter and perhaps creating an international incident?
That was absolutely one of the central points of contention of the campaign, where Hillary Clinton said that Donald Trump would be a bull in a china shop and wreck everything. And Donald Trump said, well, no, I think we need more assertive U.S. leadership. I'm normally at the Senate, and I have had a chance to speak with the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, a Republican who, by the way, is being considered for Secretary of State. We don't know who the final pick will be, but he is on that list of potential candidates. And he made an argument to me that I thought was interesting. His argument was that nobody on the world stage fears Barack Obama, that there is a sense that you can do anything and Barack Obama's response at most will be a slap on the wrist, some tut-tutting in front of a podium. And he thinks that what's truly needed, even if what Donald Trump says isn't always appropriate for the moment or the political situation, that simply having someone who is slightly unpredictable and who will not let things slide and who has a bit of a mean streak, Senator Corker was arguing that that could actually be beneficial. If he thinks that the United States needs to be feared as much as it needs to be admired. We shall see.
VOA correspondent Michael Bowman, he was speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Let's check in now with our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, about what people might be saying about Mr. Trump's phone call with the Taiwanese president. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. Yes, there was definitely lively discussion about it on Sunday news magazines, and it carried on to social media. Vice President-elect Mike Pence appeared on This Week ABC and said Trump's call with Madame Chai was nothing more than taking a courtesy call. While critics say every phone call a country's leader makes or takes has an impact, others said it was just a call and should not be interpreted as an aggressive move on Beijing, which, as you know, considers Taiwan to be part of China.
I guess like with everything, people are on either side of an issue of who can take calls and who can make calls and such. Well, I got that. What about Mr. Trump? I also trending on Twitter with his reaction to a comedy show here in the United States. It's called Saturday Night Live. He doesn't seem too happy about it.
Not really. So he sent out this tweet. Just tried watching Saturday Night Live. Unwatchable. Totally biased. Not funny. And the Baldwin impersonation just can't get any worse. Sad. In a reply to that tweet, Alec Baldwin himself, who played Trump in the weekly comedy show, tweeted this. Release your tax returns and I will stop. Huh. The American actor is using his foundation's handle at ABF Alec Baldwin.
Any reaction from Twitter users?
Steve, the top response to Trump's initial tweet received more than 53,000 likes so far, and it reads like this. You are the president-elect. Pick your battles, man. You're embarrassing yourself. One of the most common replies was asking him whether he's going to do this every week, referring to his Twitter responses to the SNL skits. Trump supporters, however, expressed they are fed up with the quote-unquote mainstream media. Although it was rather hard to find the reactions, one tweet that I did find argued that TV is absolutely trash and brainwashing. Now, this tweet appears to be in line with what Trump supporters believe in, which is that the mainstream media is not accurately nor sufficiently covering the concerns of a vast majority of Americans. Steve?
Hey, many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Longtime Cuban leader Fidel Castro, who died in November at the age of 90, was laid to rest alongside independence leader José Martí in a cemetery in the city of Santiago de Cuba, where Castro began the Cuban Revolution that took him to power in 1959. In 2006, Castro stepped down as president of Cuba, turned over the leadership to his brother Raúl. For some thoughts on Castro's legacy and what's next for Cuba, VOA's Rick Pantaleo speaks with Alana Tamino, head of the Cuba Working Group and the Senior Director of Policy at America's Society, Council of the Americas.
We have seen over the past few days and this past week a very heated debate about Fidel's legacy, and that's likely to continue for a long time. It's clear that he meant very different things for different people. As you mentioned, there was tears and mourning on one side of the Florida Straits and celebratory parades on the other in places like Little Havana and Miami. And, you know, on the one hand, you have a revolutionary hero who, for the first time, broke Cuba away from the United States. Admirers of Fidel also remark, of course, on Cuba's success story on health care and education and welfare. But he also, for many, represents an authoritarian leader who established a very strict regime that restricted freedoms and human rights for decades and presided over a state-run economic model that failed to bring prosperity to most Cubans. So it's very personal for many, especially for the exiles, the Cuban Americans in the United States and exiles who fled. But, you know, I think that it's going to continue for a long time. And what we're kind of focused on next is what comes next and what happens with Fidel's brother Raul, who has actually been at the helm of power for about a decade now. What happens with the incoming administration?
If we could, Alana, could we step back a little bit so we can get some background on Fidel Castro's rise to power, the Cuban Revolution? What sparked this? What brought Castro to power?
Fidel came to power in Cuba because, you know, his revolution really embodied the ideas that Cuba was not an equal society for all of the people. He wanted to bring socialist ideals of equality against this imperial feeling of the United States ruling Cuba with the then leader that was in charge, Batista. And so the revolution and the revolutionaries that were by his side were really centered on this socialist ideology and communist and Marxist ideology of bringing that to Cuba. And at first, I think we saw that Fidel Castro and the group of revolutionaries really focused on empowering the people, and you saw that there was going to be, you know, potentially at first, a dedication to bringing that power to the people, potentially through a more democratic society. But we saw how that changed over the years, how power was consolidated, and how that played out, I think, you know, after 1959.
And I understand initially, as he rose to power, Castro did bring some positive changes to the daily lives of the common Cuban citizen, such as health care and so on. What did he do initially?
Absolutely. I think that Fidel Castro has many success stories in terms of bringing health care to the entire population, creating a population with extremely positive literacy rates, for example, high education, low mortality rates. I think, you know, Cuba is one, I think, in Latin America with the highest literacy rates at about 99.8%. So he brought a lot of the social welfare ideals. He made great strides in that with Cuba and really leveled the playing field, I think a lot of people might say. But at the same time, time, you know, there was a complete nationalization of the economy, there was the expropriation of businesses, and you had a number of Cubans who had to flee Cuba surrounding the revolution, and many who came to the United States and to Miami, given this new way forward with the island.
So how did his good intentions and his promises of democracy soon turn into a dictatorial regime that crushed any of its political opponents? What happened here?
I think throughout the past few decades, you can see that there's always been a huge emphasis on maintaining control within Cuba. And you saw that with Fidel Castro throughout the years. You even see it now, you know, even as Cuba is trying to open up. You see that the main goal is to maintain control over the economy, control over the population, so they don't lose control given all of these other influences, whether that's from the United States or around the world. So I think that by, you know, really trying to maintain that control, a lot of those promises went away, and you saw that transition over time from 1959 until now.
That is Alana Tomino. She's head of the Cuba Working Group and Senior Director of Policy at America's Society, Council of the Americas. She was speaking with VOA's Rick Panaleo on our program, Press Conference USA. Officials in the U.S. city of Oakland, California, are continuing to sift through the charred remains of a fire that ripped through a converted warehouse, which was likely an illegal home to residents and served as an artist's workspace. Firefighters have recovered 33 bodies so far, with the death toll expected to rise. International Edition's Lori London talks about that tragedy with Alameda County Sheriff Sergeant Ray Kelly.
11:30 at night Friday, Oakland Fire responded for a report of a large structure fire. It was a warehouse that was on fire. When they got here, this place was completely engulfed in flames. As they battled those flames, they began to learn that there was people inside. They did everything in their power to try to control this fire, but it pretty much burned out of control. They finally got it extinguished. We then made fire personnel, first responders made entry in there. We began to see that there was quite a bit of people deceased inside. The building was unstable. There was a lot of hot spots, so there were still flare-ups that were occurring in the building. So it was several hours before we could even begin to start making sense of a recovery plan. For the last 36 hours or so, we have been doing that recovery, and it's very painstaking. It's very slow. We're literally using buckets and shovels to move debris in a chain link fashion out a hole that we cut in the side of the building.
I understand it was a party of some sort going on. Do you know how many people were in there at the time?
Here's the problem. We don't exactly know what kind of party or what you consider a party or what it was. We just know that there were a lot of young people inside this structure, this warehouse, and that we have many people that survived and got out and a lot of people that didn't. So there was really no in-between on this, which is strange, is that the fire moved so rapidly and so quickly that you either got out or you didn't get out. So as the hours have gone by, we have had to basically set up a deconstruction site here where we're taking this building apart piece by piece and disassembling it and putting it into big trucks and dumpsters and taking it to a safe location for further analysis later.
So when you say it was one or the other, you're saying the people that got out are okay and there weren't many severe
injuries? Yeah, so we know from checking with all our local hospitals here in the East Bay that nobody admitted themselves for any serious injuries from this fire. Our records show that nobody was even transported in an ambulance from this scene. So people either got out or they didn't get out. It's that drastic. It's that dramatic. It's very, very sad.
And any idea what caused the fire at this point? Suspicion?
We have no idea, but we have an arson task force here. We have the ATF here and all their resources at our disposal. And so we have the best experts in the United States working on this case to figure out the origins of this fire, how it happened, why it happened, and to answer all the questions that will be coming in the days and weeks ahead.
Are you expecting to find more bodies at this point? Are you expecting the number of deceased to rise?
I absolutely am expecting the number of deceased to rise.
That's Ray Kelly. He's a sergeant in the local sheriff's office and is on the scene of the Oakland warehouse fire. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
They're called Roly Blocks, and you make music with them. They're a set of modular controllers that connect to your iPhone or iPad using an app called Noise. The main controller is a 12 by 12 centimeter grid of illuminated squares, each representing a note in the chromatic scale. Express the note depending on how hard and how long you press the square. Press, tap, drag, swirl, slide, all these different motions provide different musical effects from a choice of 128 synthesized instruments in that Noise app. Rolly's Ruben Dax.
It's easy enough for someone who doesn't know anything about music to get right into it, start making music. There's all these tools to help them out, but it's also powerful enough for professionals who are looking for a new way to shape music.
Rolly Blocks are selling for $179 at Apple stores or on the Rolly website. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Well, from Rolly Blocks, as Todd was telling us about, to Rolly Balls, you might say. It's golf balls. Tiger Woods did not finish the Hero World Challenge as he would have wanted on Sunday, shooting a final round of 76 that included a double bogey at the 18th hole. But those details will be lost amid a bigger picture that saw the 14-time major champion complete 72 holes in a golf tournament for the first time since August of 2015 due to multiple back injuries. He is back, guys. Woods finished 15th in the event that took place in the Bahamas. 40-year-old Woods has won 79 PGA Tour titles, the last coming in 2013. The winner of the Hero World Challenge was Japan's Hideki Matsuyama, who was only 5 years old when he saw Tiger Woods for the very first time. It was on videotape when Tiger took the 1997 Masters victory. Well, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The growing trend of intentional shutdowns of the internet and mobile networks threaten internet freedom. According to estimates, some 25 governments on almost every continent have intentionally prevented or disrupted access to such networks more than 50 times since the beginning of 2016, a rate of at least once every 6 days. The United States earlier this year joined the consensus at the United Nations Human Rights Council in passing a resolution condemning intentional disruptions of access to or dissemination of information online in violation of human rights law. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski, noted that this Internet Freedom Resolution echoes a Freedom Online Conference joint statement from 2011 that labeled mandatory blocking of social networking technologies and platforms to be an extreme measure strictly subject to human rights law. These network disruptions have a major economic impact. A Brookings Institution report estimates that Ethiopia suffered an $8.5 million loss for an April internet shutdown. More recently, in October, Ethiopia initiated a new shutdown as part of the government's ongoing state of emergency, which may have cost the Ethiopian economy just under $500,000 U.S. dollars a day in lost GDP. It is particularly alarming that elections-related internet shutdowns are becoming increasingly common. In February, the government of Uganda ordered mobile phone and internet service providers to block access to social media sites on the day of contested national elections. Weeks later, the government of the Republic of Congo ordered a nationwide shutdown of mobile phone networks in the lead-up to national elections. But not all the news is bad. In August, Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama publicly reaffirmed Ghana's commitment to protect freedom of expression online and refrained from restricting social media use in the lead-up to national elections in December. The United States government commends the initiative taken by Ghana to reaffirm its support of human rights online. The U.S. urges the government of Ethiopia to follow suit and restore access to the global Internet for all its citizens. Likewise, all governments must protect and promote the rights to freedom of expression and association, as guaranteed under international human rights commitments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.